Good evening. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. On the NewsHour tonight, legal limbo on the southern border after an appeals court puts a Texas law allowing police to arrest and deport migrants back on hold.
Congress and the White House reach a deal to fund the government. But will it make it to President Biden's desk before a shutdown?
And a look at some of the down ballot results from yesterday's primary elections.
Welcome to the NewsHour. After a series of legal back and forths, a controversial immigration law in Texas is back in the hands of an appeals court.
The law gives state officials the power to arrest migrants whom they believe crossed into the U.S. illegally. After a Supreme Court ruling yesterday allowed Texas to enforce the law, a federal appeals court put it back on hold, and a three-judge panel heard arguments today on whether it should be enforced.
Gage DeVia from Texas Public Radio has been covering all of this and joins me now. So, Gage, the last 24 hours have really been legal whiplash for this law known as SB4. As we speak now, where do things stand with the law and its implementation?
Well, right now, SB4 is not law, and another hearing is expected in early April, which will decide whether to allow some provisions of that law to continue while litigation against it is being ruled on. So the state met in court today to discuss it, and initially Texas argued that this law should be enforced while litigation against it is pending. But by the end of the hearing and some questioning by the judges, the state asked if at the very least that state officers could arrest migrants to give them federal immigration, give them over to federal immigration authorities. But the judges said that this was already something that they do with current trespassing laws because migrants have already been arrested for that under Operation Lone Star. But just to clarify, that law is not law, even though it was for a few hours yesterday evening.
Gage, what are you hearing from those Texas state officials, the police departments and sheriff's departments on the ground? Are they ready and resourced to enforce this kind of law?
I think with police, there's almost a resounding confusion on how to enforce this law because officers are not trained for immigration enforcement, which adds to how much police are used as solvents to what are ultimately policy issues. To give an example, the Bexar County Sheriff, which is in San Antonio, has commented on how enforcing this law puts a huge liability on the department if they arrest somebody unjustly. On the legal and advocacy end, there's this fear of increased racial profiling as well along border towns and in the state at large. And there's questions on how exactly this would even be carried out, right, in terms of deportations. Mexico has already said that they would not accept deportations from Texas, and the state didn't explain this process either when it was in court today.
What are you hearing from any Border Patrol officials? I mean, these are the federal officers who are tasked with and have the authority over enforcement in these border areas. They are increasingly stretched thin amid these record numbers we're seeing at the U.S. southern border. Do they want state officers to be able to act in this way?
Well, often Border Patrol do use police or sheriff officers when they need the assistance. But as far as I know, they have not commented on this specific policy and whether it will help them. But I do know that the Border Patrol and Texas National Guard are currently at odds in Eagle Pass in terms of who is able to do what and where. BP has called for more resources before, which was part of a bill that has famously stalled in Congress, of course. But police is not necessarily part of that.
Well, earlier today, we should know Texas Governor Greg Abbott was speaking at a Texas policy summit. He reaffirmed his commitment to SB4, even as it pinballs through the courts. Here's part of what he had to say.
Texas has a right to defend ourselves, and we will use that authority to declare an invasion and fight back against that invasion.
Gage, as you know, this has really fueled a high-stakes state and federal standoff between Governor Abbott and the Biden administration. What are the implications for this beyond Texas and beyond immigration?
I think this should be seen as an attempt to codify Operation Lone Star, but without any real infrastructure to see it through. And as advocates and some Democratic members of Congress have pointed out, that these are ultimately policy issues and not policing issues. But what is happening here, much like with abortion rights through the last few years, is the state attempting to codify culture war issues as policy that don't address the needs of people in border communities or the state at large. In fact, it kind of outright harms them. So the implication there is that there are efforts at addressing these issues and others via policy that are routinely blocked by a nationalist wing of the GOP, and we will likely see that continue without some sort of federal or congressional intervention.
So you mentioned SB4 is not law now. What do we expect to happen next?
Well, it's going to be a waiting game for these next few weeks in the courts until it is heard on again, but at least at the very least, Texas police cannot arrest migrants for seeking asylum, which they are legally allowed to do so. So as of now, nothing can move on that law, but it'll just be a waiting game until early April.
Gage DeVia of Texas Public Radio joining us tonight. Gage, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Let's shift our focus now back to Capitol Hill, because Congress is racing toward another shutdown deadline, with leaders putting the finishing touches on a final funding package and lots of questions about the timeline for actually passing the legislation. It's all unfolding on a busy day at the U.S. Capitol, where Republicans are again focused on their investigation of the Biden family. Let's bring in congressional correspondent Lisa Desjardins. It's good to see you, friend.
Hi.
Here we go again. Congress is now facing this Friday deadline to fund 70% of government agencies. Where do things stand?
I want to remind people that this is a problem. We've been through this so much that there is a real danger of everyone, including members of Congress, becoming numb to this. Where we are is there is hope that they will meet this deadline, but there's also the chance that they don't. Let me take you through the calendar of where we are. As we sit, today is Wednesday. Some of us had to remind ourselves today. Today is Wednesday. The potential shutdown would begin Saturday if the spending bills are not passed by then. Partial shutdown, it would be about 70% of the agencies involved. Now, here's the situation. House Republicans have an internal pledge where any bill, they should get 3 days to read the bills. One, two, three, you count that clearly. There's not enough time to read a giant bill and pass it by Saturday. So what we have is a situation where House Republicans are preparing to waive their own internal rule to pass this by suspending the rule. And the hope is that this will be voted on in the House on Friday, quickly run across the other side of the Capitol, and then the Senate would then pass it. I don't have to tell you, I don't have to tell our viewers, the Senate does not move quickly. And so it is a big question mark as to whether the Senate can actually pass this on time. Here is what some of the leaders involved said about all this today.
I'm a rule follower, and I believe in that idea. We're also up against the crunch of the weekend, and some members on both sides of the aisle have, you know, will be traveling and that kind of thing. So we're talking about how to expedite it as quickly as possible, but also allow all the members to have an adequate time to review the legislation.
This is not a political or policy question for me. It's basic timekeeping. Amending this bill will take up time that we don't have, all but guaranteeing a shutdown. So again, no one wins a shutdown, and everyone knows what we need to do. We're almost there. We can do this.
Brian Schatzer speaking at the Leadership News Conference. Can they do it, though, is the question. This bill is going to be well over 1,000 pages, maybe 2,000 pages long. As we sit here tonight, we still don't have the text. Mm-hmm. The speaker said it was going to happen this afternoon. We're all waiting. So this is going to be incredibly close.
So the bill is not written, but there is this handshake agreement on a spending deal. We heard the House Speaker Mike Johnson say that he's a rule follower. Tell us about that, where that stands.
Right. It's important because in this era of gridlock at the U.S. Capitol, one of the main things that Congress does is pass spending bills. This is how they affect our lives in one of the most consequential ways. So breaking down what I've learned from my sources in both parties, it's going to be in this bill specifically. This includes money for the Pentagon, DHS, Homeland Security, HHS, Labor, Treasury, the White House, very big parts of our government. What they've agreed to is to, one thing, raise the number of detention beds for ICE to 42,000. That will be the largest number of detention beds funded in this country in our history. There will be no funding in this bill. It will say no funding for the next calendar year until next March for UNRWA. That is, of course, the UN agency that has come under close scrutiny because of situation in Gaza. And in addition, there will be 12,000 Afghan special visas granted. Those are for those Afghan interpreters and others who were allies of the U.S. while they're in Afghanistan. Those are specifics. Let's talk big picture. What is the point of all of this? This bill alone will be $1.2 $1 trillion in spending. Add that together with the other portion that passed recently. Total spending for this current fiscal year then will be about $1.6 trillion. What does that mean? Basically, defense is going to get a small increase over last year. All the non-defense agencies are staying about the same. That's important because Democrats were fearing big cuts there. One other note. Once all this gets through, Speaker Johnson has told House Republicans that he plans to try and tackle Ukraine. Mm-hmm. We asked him about this today. He does not have a plan for how. So we're going to watch that. And, of course, also waiting in the wings, that impeachment of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas that the House passed. Also, we will be dealing with that after this and after the House and Senate return from a spring break.
So, Lisa, if lawmakers miss the deadline, what would a weekend shutdown actually mean?
Actually, not that much. And I think that's why we could see one, because I think the pressure on the Senate is not that great when it talks about a Saturday and Sunday shutdown. For one, there is a law now in place where all furloughed government workers would have to be repaid in the end. We also know that some folks usually affected by these kinds of shutdowns in national parks would not be affected at all. They were already funded in a previous bill. The District of Columbia would not be affected. Often they are as well. I really tried to figure out the effects. Every agency will have problems, complications because of this.
Like TSA workers, for
instance. Like TSA workers, exactly. They will have to work without getting technically paid that day, but paychecks lag. One group that will be affected, here's an example, the Air Force Academy, because of how they're funded, their athletic program will continue, but they may not be allowed to have fans watch. They've got wrestling and basketball this weekend. It's that kind of stuff.
Meantime, Republicans in Congress are still trying to advance their impeachment probe of President Biden. They held a hearing today. They had hoped to hear from Hunter Biden publicly. That didn't happen. Bring us up to speed.
That's right. Hunter Biden said he couldn't attend because he wasn't asked about his calendar, and he had a court date of his own in California over tax charges. But who did attend were two Republican witnesses, one of whom is in federal prison now, a former associate of Hunter Biden's for fraud himself on different charges. The other is a man named Tony Bobulinski. Now, he says that he was privy to the idea that Joe Biden was at least adjacent to all of the Biden business schemes. And in particular, it seemed that Republicans were drilling down on one 2017 meeting that Joe Biden was said to have appeared at. This is after he left office. Here in Washington at the Four Seasons, there were Chinese officials, including the chairman of the top Chinese energy company, obviously related to the Chinese Communist Party. The person who testified to this said it was not a business conversation, but Republicans have honed in on this. And here's what Tony Bobulinski said about that.
10 Chinese individuals had to go back to mainland China and say that they were in a room with Joe Biden is the value of what they were giving.
This is the same accusation we've had, that they were selling access to Joe Biden. And he also noted that it has been shown that those Chinese officials sent millions of dollars to Hunter Biden's company shortly after that. But the problem is Democrats say Hunter Biden was doing business. Yes, maybe he was not right to be selling the idea of the Biden name, but this doesn't say that Joe Biden did anything wrong. So here's what some Democrats were pushing back. And here's Robert Garcia, Congressman.
I just want to, just for the record, be very clear that in Mr. Bobulinski's testimony, he has provided zero evidence of any sort of link between Hunter Biden and the president as far as it relates to the business dealings. And so once again, we're back to a hearing where no evidence is being provided of any sort of wrongdoing by the president.
Bobulinski disagrees, but it is circumstantial evidence right now. And now other Republicans are openly saying there's no case here. This case is unraveling. So what we learned today is that Republicans still don't have the momentum to get to impeachment that they claimed they would have a year ago.
All right, Lisa Desjardins, thanks as always for that great reporting.
Welcome.
In the day's other headlines, the Federal Reserve left short-term interest rates unchanged again, but signaled it still anticipates three cuts this year. Policymakers also estimated that inflation will stay higher than first expected into next year. Fed Chair Jerome Powell said it might mean interest rates can't come down as fast as they hoped.
We were saying that it's going to be a bumpy ride. We consistently said that. Now here are some bumps, and the question is, are they more than bumps? And we can't know that. That's why we are approaching this question carefully.
Meantime, the Congressional Budget Office projected that in 30 years' time, federal debt will reach 166% of U.S. economic output. That's actually down from the last forecast. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is back in the Middle East tonight trying to get an agreement to halt the war in Gaza. He began with a stop in Saudi Arabia to meet with the Crown Prince and his foreign minister. Blinken flies to Egypt tomorrow and then to Israel on Friday. In Washington, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer declined a request by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to speak to the Senate Democratic Caucus today. The Prime Minister spoke instead via video call to Senate Republicans. Schumer had criticized the Prime Minister last week and suggested Israel needs new elections. Today, the parties blamed each other for politicizing the issue.
I care deeply about Israel and its long-term future. When you make the issue partisan, you hurt the cause of helping Israel.
I still think our best policy is to not give any Democratic ally advice about when to have an election, who ought to run the government, or how to conduct a military campaign.
In Gaza, Palestinians report at least 28 people were killed in a series of Israeli airstrikes on Tuesday. Today, people searched for survivors after one attack on a refugee camp. And mourners said funeral prayers over the dead in central Gaza. Helicopters started airlifting American citizens out of Haiti's capital today as gang violence there raged on. The State Department announced 15 people were able to leave Port-au-Prince. Nearly 1,600 have inquired about being brought out.
And of course, the situation on the ground is one of the biggest factors into determining the frequency at which we can do this and what other options might be available to American citizens, including potential commercial options.
The airlift took place as gangs staged new attacks in the suburbs of Port-au-Prince. Caribbean officials are trying to arrange a transitional council to restore order. The Biden administration is awarding Intel nearly $20 billion in loans and grants to expand U.S. computer chip production. The president announced it today at an Intel campus near Phoenix during a Western campaign swing. And former President Trump is indicating he could support a national abortion ban at 15 weeks of pregnancy. The former president previously took credit for appointing three Supreme Court justices who voted to overturn Roe v. Wade. And on Wall Street, major stock indexes reached all-time highs after the Fed said it's still planning for three interest rate cuts this year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 401 points to close at 39,512. The NASDAQ rose 202 points. The S&P 500 added 46. And Major League Baseball's new season officially opened tonight with its first game ever in South Korea. Seoul was the setting as the Los Angeles Dodgers beat the San Diego Padres 5-2. L.A. scored four runs in the eighth inning to fuel the comeback win. And Shohei Ohtani capped the rally with a single in his Dodger debut after signing a record $700 million contract. And the U.S. is falling fast in the annual World Happiness Report. The global survey found the U.S. sliding to 23rd place from 15th last year. Americans under the age of 30 drove the drop, while seniors were much happier. The University of Oxford reports that Finland is still the happiest country. Afghanistan and Lebanon rank at the bottom. And still to come on the NewsHour, the EPA updates standards for vehicle tailpipe emissions. Hong Kong passes a second national security law, tightening China's grip and cracking down on dissent. Victims seek maximum sentences for the six Mississippi police officers who tortured and sexually assaulted them. And a new novel explores the life of an accomplished but forgotten member of the art world.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
One of the nation's most closely watched Senate races this year is now set. Ohio businessman Bernie Moreno cruised to victory in the state's U.S. Republican Senate primary last night after earning the backing of former President Donald Trump. He will take on incumbent Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown this fall in a race that will help decide control of the Senate. Following it and other elections in the state is Ohio State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Karen, always good to see you. So these results last night with this Cleveland-based businessman, Bernie Moreno, backed by Mr. Trump, beating out the other two candidates. Was this the expected outcome? I think so. And it really came down to two things, and both of them involve former President Trump. It came down to Trump's endorsement and also about $2.7 million worth of ads that were purchased by a political action committee that's connected to U.S. Senate Democrats. They had put ads out trying to portray Marino as too conservative for Ohio because he had been endorsed by Trump. And Democrats said, it seemed to be, that they wanted Marino to be the candidate who runs against Democratic incumbent Sherrod Brown. Republicans call that meddling in the election. And it turned out, potentially, that that, along with a Trump rally at the airport in Dayton on Saturday, those two things may have been the two things that really vaulted Marino over and had him win by a little over 17 percentage points.
Well, we should point out this is in a state that Mr. Trump won by 8 points in 2020. I should point out Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer told me recently that he is not worried about the Democratic incumbent, Senator Sherrod Brown. Should he be?
Well, when you look at the results from election night, Bernie Marino won in every county in Ohio, and he was facing two opponents, Secretary of State Frank LaRose and State Senator Matt Dolan. Dolan was his real competition toward the end. Dolan was more of a GOP establishment candidate endorsed by Governor Mike DeWine and former Senator Rob Portman. And yet Dolan really ended behind, well behind Marino in the final result. So the idea that Marino has done so well in so many counties against a more somebody who was perceived as a more moderate candidate, though still aligned with Trump, is interesting. And also Marino's strongest performance was in the Youngstown area. And that's an area that Sherrod Brown used to have a lot of support in. It's gone more and more Republican over time. And so that's going to be a critical area for both those candidates.
Karen, as you know, this has already been a brutal and, as you shared, a very expensive primary for Republicans so far. It's getting a lot of national attention. It's a top target for the GOP. What do we expect ahead?
I expect this to be the most expensive U.S. Senate campaign in Ohio history. It's on track for that. $56 million already involved from the three candidates who ran for the Republican nomination and Sherrod Brown himself, who has much more money than all three of the candidates who are running for the Republican nomination have put together. So certainly we're going to see it top the 2022 U.S. Senate race in Ohio, which was the most expensive race in Ohio history. And I think there's going to be a lot of interest from not only people in Ohio, but also outside Ohio, because the Senate margin is so slim. And Republicans really feel that this is a seat that they can knock off. Democrats feel that Sherrod Brown speaks to not only their voters, but also can reach more moderate Republicans and voters who are independent. So it's really going to be a battle, I think.
There's another key House race I know you're following in Northwest Ohio. There's a Trump-backed candidate there, Derek Marin, who won his primary. He's now going to face Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur in November. Is this a seat that Republicans could flip?
Well, Marcy Kaptur is the longest-serving woman in Congress, and she's been popular even after her district was redrawn to really try to make it more competitive. Last time she ran against a candidate, J.R. Majewski, a Trump-aligned candidate, he ran this time but had to drop out because of derogatory comments that he made about Special Olympians that got him in trouble. And that whole situation, as well as the other candidates in the race, really seemed to benefit Derek Marin, who himself was involved in a battle over leadership in the Ohio House. And so his name being out there with that may have helped him win that contest. But he does have an uphill battle in facing Marcy Kaptur.
A lot to follow in Ohio. We are so glad you're here to help us with that. That is Ohio State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Karen, thank you very much.
Great to talk to you. Thanks.
The Biden administration has finalized what are the toughest standards for vehicle emissions that limit the amount of greenhouse gases allowed from tailpipes. The new rules are designed to accelerate the transition to electric vehicles, but it hasn't come without some pushback. David Shepherdson is covering all of this for Reuters, and he joins us now. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
So the Biden administration is rolling out these new standards for passenger cars and trucks designed to push the U.S. auto market toward electric vehicles and hybrids. What's the EPA's expectation for that transition under this new rule?
It's pretty aggressive. So these rules start in 2027 and go through 2032. And by 2030, you'd have at least 50% plug-in hybrids and full electric vehicles under the various scenarios that auto companies can use to comply. But as you said, they can, you know, pick from a mix of different options, you know, hybrids, plug-ins, advanced gasoline vehicles. And unlike the initial proposal, which had projected that there'd be 60% all EVs by 2030 and 67% EVs, that, those numbers are coming down because EPA is slowing the rate of increase and giving auto companies a break through 2030.
Well, to your point, I mean, the fact that these rules are being rolled out more slowly, companies have more choices in terms of how they can comply. Toyota, which is the world's largest automaker, they were pretty forceful in their initial pushback. What was their argument?
So their argument was that plug-in hybrids can save, you know, an equivalent or more CO2 because they have smaller batteries, can be deployed across more vehicles as opposed to larger batteries in single vehicles. And that argument, I think, had a lot of resonance with the administration and with other advocates. So the rule incentivizes plug-ins further by giving them additional credits, which they were not going to get originally. So the new rule really looks far more holistically at advanced vehicles, looking at both EVs and plug-ins, rather than focusing primarily, as the earlier proposal did, on EVs.
That concession, allowing more plug-in hybrids, what does that say about the demand for pure electric vehicles?
Well, it's not moving as fast as people had thought. Now, certainly it's still rising, but there have been some troubling signs. You know, auto companies like Ford have cut back production, like the F-150 Lightning. We've seen other auto companies like GM delay some significant EV projects. So, you know, it is still rising. We're at about 8% we were in last year, and it's going to continue to go up, but there are concerns that very high level of increase we've seen the last few years is going to moderate, and the companies are not going to be able to meet these very aggressive standards.
What about the infrastructure for electric vehicles? When are all of those new chargers, when is that supposed to come online?
Right, because remember the administration spending, you know, $7.5 billion to get hundreds of thousands of chargers in place, and there's really not many of them, really just a few dozen, roughly. So I think the argument the administration's making is we're going to see all of those by 2030 or earlier, right? And so the battery factories will be online, a lot more vehicles will be in place, and the charging infrastructure will be much more robust. So in theory, the conditions are there to, you know, have a much, you know, more aggressive, you know, robust take rate on EVs than we have now. But there's certainly, critics say, if you take your foot off the gas, so to speak, then you're not going to, that auto companies might slow that change, might be a little, you know, maybe less willing to make the full investment toward EVs.
Take your foot off the gas, so to speak.
Exactly.
So, well, look, there are a lot of political battle lines being drawn around all of this. Donald Trump has railed against electric vehicles. The United Auto Workers Union, which has endorsed President Biden, they've expressed a lot of concern about job protections and wage protections for people who build the cars and build the EV batteries. Right. Help us understand that dynamic.
So, you know, President Trump certainly has been very bombastic, right? In his administration, he sought to roll back and did roll back some of the greenhouse gas standards that were reinstated and then increased by the Biden administration. But, you know, one of the benefits to plug-in hybrids that both the UAW, Toyota, you mentioned, others like, is that they still have internal combustion engines, so they require more workers to build those. That's what the UAW likes them. That's why many Americans are more comfortable, because if you run out of electricity, you can still put gasoline in that vehicle. So, at least for the short term, there's a lot of, you know, people who like that vehicle, even though the environmental benefits are somewhat in dispute, given we don't know how much that vehicle is going to be charged versus on gasoline. But there's no question that this issue in those key states, right, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, those auto states, so that the former President Trump's, you know, haranguing about EVs, and the Biden administration's arguing, hey, this is going to, you know, ensure we're competitive with China and we're going to create more jobs on net with all these new battery factories is going to be a key decider what side he'll come down on in the election.
David Shepherdson, thanks so much for your reporting and insights. I could talk to you about this all day.
Thanks, Joe.
All right, take care.
Beijing criticized the West today for questioning Hong Kong's new national security law known as Article 23. The once mostly autonomous city is now led by legislators entirely handpicked by Beijing, who swept aside years of concerns by pro-democracy advocates to pass the bill in record time. Critics say the legislation is a death blow to whatever independence the city still had. Here now is Nick Schifrin.
In Hong Kong, this is how liberty dies, unanimously. By a vote of 89-0, Hong Kong's Legislative Council passed a law that authorities say safeguards the city's security.
I'm sure Hong Kong will do better going forward. We will become more prosperous, more safe, more secure going forward. And this legislation is good for everybody.
In this once liberal gateway to mainland China, Article 23 expands Hong Kong's authorities' ability to punish dissent. Crimes linked to state secrets and sedition can now be punished for 10 years. Espionage can carry a sentence of 20 years. And treason, insurrection, and sabotage are punishable with life imprisonment.
Article 23, basically, in a business community point of view, is that it will make Hong Kong more similar to China in terms of operating environments.
Kelvin Lam was a local Hong Kong politician and macroeconomist with HSBC Hong Kong and is now based in London.
How do you define state secrets and how do you define espionage activities? It's up to the prosecutors. And as you know, that judicial independence in Hong Kong is now kind of not completely there anymore. So that's why the foreign businesses are more worried about this kind of new law.
Free Hong Kong! Free Hong Kong!
For decades, Hong Kong prided itself on its freedom of speech. And in 2019, tens of thousands of demonstrators protested a law that required extradition to mainland China. In July, the protesters turned violent and occupied the Legislative Council. One protester told me that day he was unrepentant.
Some may say we're blocking the glass door, the entrance. We are breaking every of the government properties. But yeah, they can say it's a violence, but the tyrant's there.
Beijing used the violence to pass a national security law that jailed thousands of peaceful protesters, shut down independent media, and imprisoned pro-democracy activists. The U.S. said Article 23 further silences Beijing's critics.
We believe that these kinds of actions have the potential to accelerate the closing of Hong Kong's once open society.
But the law's backers don't seem to care about foreign criticism or international financial anxiety.
Hong Kong is such a beautiful place for doing business and traveling into Hong Kong. So if they don't come, if they don't do business here, they miss their chances.
For perspective on what Article 23 means for Hong Kong, we turn to Anna Kwok, Executive Director of Hong Kong Democracy Council, which fights for democracy and human rights in Hong Kong. The government of Hong Kong has levied a bounty of $1 million Hong Kong dollars for her arrest. Anna Kwok, thank you very much. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
To the NewsHour. The national security law that we described that Beijing, Hong Kong passed a few years ago already stifled protesters, already stifled media freedoms, already silenced dissent. So how does Article 23 go further?
Well, you're right that the national security law was implemented in 2020, and it was definitely a watershed moment for Hong Kong. But if the NSL was a watershed moment, I would say Article 23 is actually a nail in the coffin on Hong Kong as this global international financial hub that we have seen. Because with Article 23, there's this ambiguous theft of state secret. You don't even know what state secret is. And there's also intention to apply the law to Hong Kongers abroad and also to foreigners who work in Hong Kong, foreigners who have some sort of relations of Hong Kong, and now even communicating with foreign organizations can also be accused of breaking Article 23. So it really expanded the legal ground for the government to criminalize Hong Kongers for basically just having connection to the outside world. So that would definitely change the future of Hong Kong forever.
Authorities in Hong Kong, as you heard in that story, say the law was necessary because it'll make the city safer and because this ends the risk of violence in Hong Kong. What do you say to that?
Well, I think we're all very clear about where the violence is in Hong Kong. It's from the Hong Kong police force. And I definitely do not think that, you know, Article 23 is actually addressing what they want to address. But instead, I think it's their way to please the Beijing government and also to really double down on the kind of global authoritarian expansion that the Chinese Communist Party has been conducting everywhere in the world, including in Taiwan, including in Southeast Asia, many other countries.
As we said, so many activists, pro-democracy demonstrators are already in prison.
Yeah.
Could Article 23 be applied retroactively and actually extend their sentences longer?
Well, It's the same as the national security law, even though the government clarified that it would not be applied retroactively. But it did happen that the government would use evidence from years ago to say that, oh, this person has been with the intent to treason for a long time. So that's what we're expecting from Article 23 as well.
And could it also be used, as you mentioned, against overseas activists, even perhaps without the people who are living overseas without their knowledge that Article 23 is actually being imposed or being used against them, whether it's about passports or about anything else?
Yeah, definitely. So last year there was the case of a Hong Kong student, you know, studying in Japan. She only found out that she was accused of breaking the law once she entered Hong Kong, once she, you know, left her flight. And that's what we're expecting to happen more and more with Article 23. So there's a huge chilling effect happening among Hong Kongers that they will censor themselves even if they're abroad. And with the passport, in Article 23, it also mentioned that absconders like myself will have my passport invalidated by the government. Now, how they will actually do that, it's not clear, because they cannot come to the U.S. and collect my passport per se, but they will definitely make it known to other governments around the world that these passports of people will be invalidated. And it's also very likely that people will only find out when they try to use that Hong Kong passport to pass customs and pass borders.
We heard the State Department Deputy Spokesperson Vedant Patel in the story from before making a statement against the law. But what are you asking the U.S. government, the Biden administration, and also Congress to actually do? What actions are you pushing for now?
Right. I'm urging the Biden administration to impose sanctions on high-ranking Hong Kong officials, prosecutors who are responsible for Article 23 national security law and abusing human rights. The last time that any sanctions was placed was already 3 years ago. In 2024.
The Trump administration sanctioned Hong Kong leaders then.
Exactly, right. Exactly. And now, you know, in the past 3 to 4 years, we have seen like more than 1,800 political prisoners, but we're still not imposing more sanctions on that. I think that is very alarming. So that's why that's one of my asks. And for Congress, I really hope that we can pass the Hong Kong Economic and Trade Office Certification Act as soon as possible, since that will recertify whether these offices by the Hong Kong government can still have their privileges and, you know, rights here in the U.S.
Essentially, Hong Kong diplomats who are based in the United States, not Chinese mainland diplomats, but Hong Kong diplomats, who you believe, what, have been acting inappropriately in the United States?
Yeah, so they definitely receive orders from Beijing, and they have also conducted surveillance against Hong Kong diaspora in the U.S. So that has really posed a lot of danger for us. And we have also seen how Hong Kong government utilized their network here in the U.S. to lobby against legislations that were pushing forward. So that's why having these offices here will be very dangerous, you know, in terms of transnational repression as well going forward.
And finally, a little personally, if you don't mind, you were anonymous back in 2019 when some of those protests that we were showing were spreading. You started your public advocacy in 2021. And as I said, today you have a $1 million Hong Kong dollar bounty on your head. The U.S. government has accused Beijing of transnational repression. Do you feel safe here?
Well, I wish I could feel safe, but honestly, I don't feel the safest here in the United States. A few months ago in San Francisco, I was protesting against Xi Jinping because he was here to have his bilateral talk with President Biden. And on the streets of San Francisco, there were people following me, tailing me, and there were also a number of pro-Xi protesters attacking Tibetan activists. Some of them were beaten with head injuries. So I think there's a lot of things going on that we're not, you know, really prying to look into yet. But transnational repression is definitely happening. And that's why whenever I walk on the streets, I would always look back to see if anyone is following me. And I was always have to be very careful about my whereabouts. And I think that really tells how deep transnational repression and how infiltrated it has become here.
Anna Kwok, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In Mississippi, two more police officers were given lengthy sentences today for their role in a series of brutal attacks, including against two black men. They're part of a group of former officers who are being sentenced this week after pleading guilty to horrifying charges that include torture and sexual assault. John Yang has more.
Amna, a federal judge in Mississippi, has just handed down the harshest sentence yet in a startling case of law enforcement misconduct. 40 years in prison for the fourth former deputy in the self-proclaimed goon squad in the Rankin County, Mississippi Sheriff's Department. A total of six former deputies have pleaded guilty. Federal prosecutors say that for nearly two decades, they barged into homes in the middle of the night, handcuffing and torturing occupants for information or confessions. The current charges stem from a January 2023 home invasion of the residence of Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker. The officers repeatedly shocked them with tasers, sexually assaulted them with a sex toy, and shot Jenkins in the face, nearly killing him. Parker spoke to reporters after one of the sentencing hearings.
What's done already, man, can't be erased, man, can't be taken back. I relive this every day.
The years of brutal misconduct was documented by an investigation by Mississippi Today and the New York Times Local Investigations Fellowship. Brian Howe is an investigative reporter at Mississippi Today. He was part of this reporting team. Brian, the severity of this behavior and the fact that it went on so long really is eye-grabbing, sort of very startling. Tell us how this self-proclaimed goon squad came about. How did it get started? How big was it? How did they pick the people they targeted?
Thanks, Sean. Well, it's unclear how the goon squad was actually started, but we do know that this pattern of behavior involved a core group of deputies stretching back nearly 20 years. They chose their targets based on these people's alleged crimes. They mainly went after folks that they suspected of dealing or possessing methamphetamine or other drugs. Then after they found them, they would burst into their homes or pull them over while they were driving and begin these brutal interrogations that often involved anywhere from repeated tasings to waterboarding to burning, you name it.
I mean, this has been going on for some time, say two decades. How many other cases are there out there, do you think?
Well, we don't know how many cases there are out there, but we interviewed over 50 people who claimed they experienced or witnessed torture at the hands of Rankin County deputies. Of those, we were able to corroborate 17 torture incidents involving 20 victims dating back 18 years.
The sheriff is resisting calls to resign. How high up did knowledge about this go? How senior supervisors were aware of this?
You're right, John. The sheriff has resisted calls to resign and has claimed numerous times that he had no knowledge of his deputy's actions. But what we found were that some of the highest ranking deputies at the sheriff's department were involved and actively partaking in these torture incidents. And we spoke to multiple people who claimed they were tortured by deputies who said that they filed complaints with the department, which should have gone to the sheriff, and in some cases even reached out directly to him to notify him of his deputy's actions.
What does this say about the culture of the department?
Well, it says that there's potentially a deeply ingrained culture of violent misconduct at the Rankin County Sheriff's Department. This culture has actually been referenced several times in the sentencing hearings this week by some of the deputies themselves, who themselves acknowledged that they were indoctrinated into this culture and became a part of it as they went on at the Sheriff's Department.
The Rankin County is majority white. It sits right next to Jackson, which has one of the highest percentages of black population of any good-sized city in America. To what extent is there a racial dimension to this?
We found that the majority of the alleged victims who were tortured by goon squad members were actually white, and we think that that's because we are looking at a majority white county. However, when people of color came forward and said that they were tortured, there was often a racial aspect to the torture. They were called racial slurs. They were told to go back to Jackson, which is a common phrase, referring to Jackson and how many people at the department and in Rankin County see the city as a source of crime and corruption.
Do you think this is going on in other counties in Mississippi?
It's hard to say. We do know that across Mississippi, sheriff's departments have very little to no oversight. Our team, Alyssa Daly and Jerry Mitchell, have uncovered other accusations of sexual assault by sheriffs at different departments. And so it's clear here that we have an issue of accountability with sheriffs generally in Mississippi.
He said this has been going on for two decades. Complaints went to the sheriff's department to no avail. How did this escape the notice of statewide officials, of federal officials?
That's a great question, John. I'd love to know that myself. We do know that a state investigation into the incident involving Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker is sort of what initiated all of this in the first place. But as far as we know, so far, state and federal officials only recently became aware of the conduct at the Rankin County Sheriff's Department.
And the trials that have been going on, the sentencing has all been in federal court. Are any local county officials, the county prosecutor, looking into this?
Yes, all of the deputies who face sentencing in federal court this week will also face another round of state sentencing in the coming weeks.
Brian Howie of Mississippi Today, thank you very much.
Thanks, John. I appreciate it.
A new novel takes on art and personal history, using fiction to explore the lives of both the author and an important art world figure. Jeffrey Brown has the story for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
It was a celebration of a local writer. So Chill Gonzalez grew up in a working-class neighborhood of Brooklyn and was now surrounded by fans and friends at the Center for Fiction, a nonprofit literary organization, as she released her new novel, one that comes with some big questions at its heart.
There's that adage, like, history is told by the victors. That includes sometimes art history. I think that now we have to start questioning what are the ways in which we decide that something has value.
Anita DeMonte Laughs Last is a tale of two women, parallel lives a generation apart. Anita, a Cuban-born rising star in the New York art world. Raquel, a Latina student, finding her way at an Ivy League college. The latter, Gonzalez told me at her Brooklyn apartment, very much based on her own experience.
You know what's funny? I really thought that we were going to be very different. And then as I was walking her through a day, I realized that some of the things that maybe I felt in college were inevitable. That kind of change and not really being able to expect it, and then not being able to maybe explain it to your family, like your baseline, it results in a little bit of isolation.
It's you bumping up against issues of class and race.
Class and race, and I think just sort of conditioning to some extent.
Gonzalez, daughter of a Puerto Rican mother and Mexican-American father, was raised by her maternal grandparents. She attended public schools and then through scholarships and loans, Brown University, where she struggled at times with feelings of dislocation, whether she was prepared enough and belonged there, and whether others thought so. All captured later in her fictional character, Raquel.
I felt that I hadn't seen what I knew to be a pretty broad experience of having this triumph, like you get into this amazing college and then it is personally just so difficult. Like, and I've said this to a college administrator maybe 10 years ago. I was like, you know, we were invited to the table, but nobody set us out forks and knives.
That's how it felt.
Yeah, that's how it felt. And so you're sort of oscillating between being really frustrated and like looking around and being like, I need to eat. And how do I not embarrass myself? Like, you know, I need to figure this out. And how do I do this without embarrassing myself? Mm-hmm. And I just felt there was like a swath of people, you know, Latinas always first, but like, you know, a swath of people of color, people from lower class experiences that I know had walked this path that Raquel had walked.
In fact, it would take Gonzalez herself almost 20 years after graduating before she took up writing. She built a wedding planning business for, her term, rich hipsters, experience that found its way into her breakout debut novel, Olga Dies Dreaming.
I had to make a living first. Yeah. There were a lot of loans. Yeah. I walked out of there with a lot of loans, and I think it felt to me a little daunting. And then my grandmother, who was sort of the inspiration for Raquel's mom, when she passed away, I just felt like, I think now I can kind of do whatever I want. Just happened right before I turned 40, which is always a good time to decide you can do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'm just going to start writing now.
You took the leap at around 40.
Yeah. And wow. I'd say because I came from such a working class background, and I've, you know, had a a nice run through a bunch of different experiences, I think I'm able to come at things with a slightly different angle. Walking through life from the outside of the perimeter gives you a lot of different perspectives on the inside of the circle.
There's a lot less sense of neighborness and connectivity, I think, as things change. And that's probably the thing I'm the most obsessed with.
She's also now bringing that perspective to cultural change in her city and others, writing essays on gentrification, race, and class for The Atlantic. Last year, she was a Pulitzer Prize finalist for her commentary. The new novel's dedication gives a clue to its other main character. Anita is based on the real-life Anna Mendieta, a performance artist, sculptor, and painter best known for incorporating her own body into her work, often set in nature. Tragically, she's also known for her death in 1985 at age 36, when she fell or was pushed out of an apartment window. Her husband, Carl Andre, older and a major figure in the art world when the two met, was charged with her murder, but acquitted. His place in art history is assured, but what of hers? Gonzalez wondered why she herself had barely heard of Mendieta, even studying art history in college, and only learned of her by accident outside the classroom.
The discovery of Anna Mendieta, the discovery of kind of Caribbean art and Puerto Rican art, it was my first time realizing that I have to seek out legacy and what can I do to, like, you know, learn my own history and talk about it and give it some space. And I think it made me just realize that, like, you can't just take everything at face value. My youthful presumption was, oh, well, then it mustn't be good enough to not be in this classroom. And suddenly I was like, oh, or maybe that's not quite the case. And I have to just work and try to nudge in the narrative and add people in.
In a recent New York Times article, the family of Anna Mendieta raised concerns about fictionalizations of her life and death, including this one. Her estate refused to let us show photos it owns of the artist or her work. For her part, Gonzalez says this of her decision to give Mendieta a fictional voice.
I don't think that artists should ask for permission to make their art. To me, I felt that I was respectful to the story. I was very clear about how I felt about what happened to her legacy in the aftermath. And I felt it was also about the influence that she's had on other generations, including myself and my generation. And so to me, that was the highest form of respect that I could probably pay.
Novelist, essayist, she's also eager to work in TV and films, including a possible adaptation of her first novel. Gonzalez says there's one clear thread in all her work.
What I always try to center in all of my pieces, like in Olga and in this book, is this is a Latino experience, but it's an American experience. And these are, you know, American women, and I want to see those experiences reflected.
All right, the book is Anita DeMonte Laughs Last, Xochitl Gonzalez. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We invite you to join us again here tomorrow night as we'll have a look at the health consequences of being evicted. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you for joining us.